This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening. I'm Hilary Harper. I host the Saturday morning program on ABC Radio Melbourne. It's lovely to be here with you tonight. And I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nations and pay my respects to their elders past and present. We're here tonight to hear two extremely engaged and generous women, and it's such a timely, vital topic tonight to chat about. Amal Awad is the author of Beyond Veiled Clichés, The Real Lives of Arab Women, though she says that co-creator might be a better word with the women that she spoke to, or midwife even. She's a columnist, novelist and journalist, and she spent her childhood watching the TV show Chips in Leg Warmers, so kindred spirit.
Yes.
And Jumana El-Matra migrated from Lebanon as a child. She's worked in the welfare sector for over 20 years here. She's been CEO of the Australian Muslim Women's Centre for Human Rights for 15 years. And she's researched the impact of the human rights movement on Muslim women internationally and the role of gender in violent extremism as well. But we're going to have a chat about things that sound less terrifying, the lives of women generally. Amal, I had this really odd conversation the other day with a woman in my child's circus class, and I said, I'm going to be doing this event, I'm really excited about it. And she said, she's of European extraction, she said, I would find it really hard to describe the stereotypes that I thought were applied to me. Surely you should be talking to the people who apply the stereotypes. And I wonder what your reaction was to that. Do women in the Middle East have any problem at all isolating the stereotypes that are applied to them?
In the Middle East?
The Middle East or here, I guess.
In the Middle East, Arab women are completely uninterested in how people perceive them. I did an event in Sydney where I said, Arab women just don't care what you think, and someone tweeted that. And I was like, oh, I sound so blasé about it. But what I was trying to say was they are not consumed by how people perceive them, but they are very much aware of the misconceptions. So it's not a head-in-the-sand kind of situation, but they're not consumed by it. In Australia, it's a totally different situation because identity and belonging are huge themes. They emerged in just about every conversation I had. So, yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, you write so wonderfully about the ways you navigated your multiple identities as a child and a young person and now. And I found it really interesting that that so many identities play on all of us, but some of them are isolated as meaningful. And some of the things that happen to you in the workplace are just horrific. The bigotry layered on all those different identities towards you. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think the best way to simplify that or summarise it is to say that as a woman who has multiple identities, as you put it, whether I like it or not, I was born into an Arab family, I was born into a Muslim family. In a Western country, those labels matter. And you make them matter to yourself because you want to belong and you're tribal, and then one day maybe you're not, and I'm not as tribal now. And the thing is, people will constantly remind you as well. So it becomes a matter of... I think one of the events I mentioned in the book was, I'm a journalist by background, former lawyer. I have to mention that every time because my parents want me to. and I don't know if anyone here can relate to the newsroom, but people swear, and it's not like a friendly place in that sense. And it's okay, you develop a thick skin. But I used to wear the headscarf, and one day I showed up without it, and I think people just they don't know what to do with that, but. A few weeks later, I think my manager at the time said, you know, you're different now, you're confident. And I said, what? Did you not know me before? Like, I've always been confident in what I do if I know what I'm doing. But in his mind, I had transformed into somebody who was a bit more threatening because now you're cocky and confident. And I thought, well, no, if I was cocky before, if I'm cocky now, I was cocky before, but I wasn't. But it was that confidence. I never forgot that statement. And then there was another time when I objected to something in the workplace, and this was a different one. And I expressed my, my concerns about a decision that had been made. And this manager said, I don't know what it is about you, Amal. Maybe it's the men in your life or the way you've been brought up, but you just seem to have a real problem with authority. I'm like, what the hell just happened? All I said was, I don't understand the logic behind the decision you've made. But as an Arab woman, I was challenging him, and he related it back to my upbringing. And I really didn't appreciate the insinuation there, because a lot of people have issues growing up with male authority or female authority even. It's not a cultural thing. It's a human thing. So they're just two examples, but they really stand out for me because it was when I understood that you can look like everyone else, but you're not like everyone else until they decide you are. So it just depends on whether or not you care.
And Jumana, you've been working in the sector for a long time. Are you seeing attitudes shift at all?
No. I'm seeing a lot of people try to take more care. But I guess the more regressive attitudes, the attitudes that are corrosive, sort of, you know, come and go. But it's almost like, you know, there'll be a terrorist incident and it's like you've taken the lid off, they'll, you know, come back exactly as they were, untouched, unmediated, and present themselves again. The positive news, though, is that I think that people now are asking more questions and are taking a bit more care. But I think that that's around Islam. Amal, I'm not sure about your experience, and really not about Arabs. But my view has always been that the problems, the sort of stereotypes around Islam, really evolve from people's dis-ease with Arabs rather than Islam itself.
Just before we start talking about the women that you interviewed in their and their amazing lives, I wanted to ask quickly, Jumana, you speak in the book about the idea that racism against Arabs in Australia is a particular kind. Can you tell us more about that?
I think that people take... we know that it's not acceptable to be racist, and most of us don't want to be racist, and that is a really a sort of genuine commitment. And I've seen, and you know, I think I've been working for more than 20 years, but I've seen people try to take a lot of care. And so you can see people being, you know, giving a special consideration for minorities. I've not seen that in relation to Arabs. I've always experienced racism towards Arabs as being very uncomplicated, that there are many things that are wrong with Arabs, including the way, you know, that most especially the way they treat their women. And everybody assumes that they know how Arabs treat their women. And most people assume that they understand what is happening in the Arab world. And the Arab world is about conflict, and it's about war, and it's about dispossession. And it's about the oppression of women, and it is only about those things. And you don't get the sort of questioning that you might get about other assumptions that get made about other communities across the world.
Do you have thoughts about why that might be specifically here?
Look, I think that there's been really a lot of stereotyping, and there's been a lot of propaganda, and a lot of the literature that came out about the Middle East in the West's original engagement with the Middle East. Through colonisation, really spent a lot of time denigrating the culture. And I know a lot of scholars have written about that and have said that that's not necessarily, say, what happened with India when there was an occupation of India, that the denigration of Arabs started then and hasn't really shifted very much. And I think because there's so much turmoil in the Middle East still, that people don't feel that those things have to be investigated. And we still talk about, you know, human rights not being valued in the Middle East, and you see Muslims and Arabs dying on the streets for their human rights. I mean, what higher price can you pay? Emma?
I just wanted to say, I think it's even as simple as Hollywood. I don't think it has to be... I mean, I completely agree with you, but, you know, there's a book called Real Bad Arabs, R-E-E-L, and this man basically went back from in the history of cinema in the US and just recorded every instance of when an Arab was portrayed, and it was, I think, 97% horrible. And, you know, there were just always the other, and they were always sort of swarthy males and dangerous, and women, don't even get me started on how women are portrayed. So where do you go from there? That's a really problematic thing, because it's such a subconscious thing as well.
And the power of books too. I mean, C.S. Lewis always has these kind of swarthy, yeah, scimitar-wielding villains, you know.
And I actually discovered something the other day. I'm sure a lot of you would have seen Disney's Aladdin. And I've always, like, as an adult, I felt quite ashamed that I'd watched it and liked it. So I was like, what? Did I not see how racist this is? But I was just that excited that the Arab world was being recognised that I thought, I'll take what I can get. And I was 15, you know. But as an adult, I was horrified how racist it was, but I didn't even realise that something someone had pointed out to me was the bad guys all speak with an accent and the good guys speak in an American accent. And they're all Arabs. And I actually didn't... didn't even think, but that's how subconscious it is. It's just so
ingrained, yeah.
Subliminal.
Well, and with Beyond Veiled Clichés, I mean, why did you feel the need to write this book? Aren't there lots of books where people wander off to the Middle East and peer into Arab women's
exactly,
lives?
That's why I needed to write it, because they're not Arab. And I was getting really irritated, and I thought, well, this is just feeling really uncomfortable to me, because I felt like a specimen, and I don't discount the value of those books completely. It's not to say the stories contained in them are wrong or these women didn't have good intentions, but you're treading on very tricky ground, I think, when you start to say, I know better and I'm going to show what's wrong with this. And that's the energy of those books. I felt they were holding up their lives against their own and saying, oh my God, thank God, I'm not an Arab woman. And I don't see the point of that. But I also felt like we're at a really interesting intersection right now, in Australia especially. I am the product of a particular generation. I'm 38. What is it like to be a woman who has to navigate those cultures, and how have I navigated them up until now? And am I alone in that journey? How did other women growing up in this country navigate them? What if you're an immigrant Arab woman? These things matter now, because we're talking about race all the time. And I also thought, well, what's the difference between Arab women here and in the Middle East? And I really just wanted to examine it, even if it was in a limited capacity. I knew I had limitations, but I felt like I don't think I've read a book like this, so I decided I should write it.
Well, and how were you received by the women that you spoke to? I mean, what were their expectations of people coming in and trying to know them?
I think, look, the fact is Arab women have spoken to non-Arab women, so I don't think they're necessarily antagonistic to outsiders coming in. In fact, I don't think Arabs are antagonistic to outsiders at all. I should point that out. But there's a difference between examining your culture from an outside perspective to say, let's look for the faults here, or as a group saying, let's talk about our lives. Let's just talk about the reality of life as a woman who happens to be Arab. And I really hope that by the end of the book, if you choose to read it, you will see them as women. And this is the thing. I don't want to hit you on the head with ideas and convince you of something. I want you to read it and just connect and just understand the universality of these experiences. So that's kind of where it was coming from.
Some of the stories that I really loved were about the creativity that some of these women were involved in, performance artists or mm-hmm. art therapists. Tell us about some of the projects or creativity that you encountered and the effects of the context that they were living in on those projects.
I'm sorry, I don't think I actually answered your question, did I?
They received
me pretty well, I should say. I think I'm a nice person, so I didn't have any problems. There were a couple of women who were a bit frosty, only because I think they just found it hard at the start. But by the end, most people want to share something of themselves. And when they introduced themselves, the interesting thing was, the first thing I would say is, please introduce yourself, your name, you know, your age, what do you do? And they will always throw in this extra line. And that was the thing that usually told me what they wanted to talk about. So women want to talk about their lives. It's the audience. It's like, am I telling you this to convince you, or am I telling you this because I have a voice and I want to use it? So that was where I was coming from. In terms of the performance artists, yeah, there was, in Lebanon, there was a clown. Literally, that's her job title. clowning is actually a really interesting thing. So clowning is a whole art form where people get to know their inner clown. And she went and studied, I think, in London or something. And she goes into refugee camps now, and she works with women and helps them to empower themselves, really. She doesn't see herself as like waving a magic wand over these women. And the thing about Lebanon was, it was full of those women, like artists, women who were a little bit more daring in that sense. They're trying to challenge the status quo. But she was quite memorable because she had a performance called The Caravan, and so she actually got Syrian refugees involved in telling their life stories, and they took it around like the Middle East, and they would just stop, you know, with this caravan and perform for people. And it was just a really beautiful example of how sometimes the simplest things, it's always story related, by the way, that's how we connect stories, just make people feel alive, you know.
Well, she sounded like an incredible personality, really vibrant and powerful, you know.
Always getting into trouble with people.
Yeah, but it was interesting how it sounded like, you know, some aspects of what she did were difficult for her as a woman in that context, but she didn't care.
She got picked on by men a lot if they were conservative. She tells this really funny story where she's in a marketplace, or I don't know, in Jordan. She was in Jordan performing on the street. So what she does is she takes her clown gear and she'll just drop it somewhere and just perform. And usually she's relating someone's story, so it won't be like a whimsical thing. It will actually be that she's interviewed someone about their life and then she's relating that story. But she'll be dressed in like red nose, whatever. And apparently a cleric came up to her and just started, you know, shouting obscenities at her and you're going to hell. And she has very frizzy hair. She's, I think, Christian, but not really a believer. But this man was just basically, you know, saying you're on your way to hell and whatever. And I said to her, what did you do? And she said, well, I just let him finish. And then I said, thank you very much. That was a wonderful performance. And I clapped. And I said, well, what happened? She goes, well, everybody started clapping too. And he just went nuts. But I thought, God, that's powerful. Like, how powerful is it to be able to contain yourself in that way? Of course, in other instances, she relates examples where she wasn't so patient. She got really angry at these men who were, you know, like, I don't think she said that she attracts this kind of thing because she's free. She's free in her body. She would sit like, and when I was talking to her, she was like straddling the bench and moving her legs around. And I don't know, like in a culture like Arab, I don't know if you would agree with this, Jemana, but like you've got to sit a certain way and you don't, you know, you just sew and everything's about appearance. And she just did not care. She just threw convention to the wind. So of course it's going to challenge people who really want to see women behaving a certain way.
And the other interesting thing that struck me about her was that she was talking about growing up in a place that had seen 30 years of conflict. Yep. And the effect that it had on finding her inner clown. Her inner clown was pretty frightening.
Yeah, militant. Yeah, she said she didn't realise that she thought she was, like, you know, cool as cucumbers. And she, is that a saying? I don't know.
Yeah, she cool was, as a cucumber.
Yeah, she thought she was cool as a cucumber, and she realised she was this really militant kind of angry person inside.
She made this machine gun.
Machine gun, yeah. And the thing that was interesting about her was she had imaginary friends growing up to help her because she moved like 13 times during the Civil War. So one thing you need to remember about Lebanon is the women there, all of them without fail, I don't know a single Lebanese woman I spoke to who has not been affected in some way by the Civil War. And some people would call it actually a regional war on Lebanese soil. So it depends on how you look at it. And one of the other interesting women in the book is Mira, from Lebanon, who says, well, this country hasn't healed, because Beirut is very chaotic. Have you been, Jemana? You've been to,
yes,
like, in recent years?
I actually read when you described it as chaotic, and I was thinking, I didn't notice. It just seemed like any other city to me.
Like any other Middle Eastern city, really.
Yeah, it was just, it was calm, actually, I thought.
Oh, okay. Well, I think it's like, for me, it was like a more hyper version of Amman, or maybe, I don't know, it's just a different version. And I remember just, the city got the better of me a little bit because I was just a little bit stressed out. I had a lot of things on my mind, and I showed up to her studio and I was just like, it's like this country is fighting itself. And she said, that's such an interesting way of putting it. And it is, because, you know, we haven't healed from civil war. We haven't gone through the five stages of healing or whatever it is that you have to go through. And Lebanon has become very good at the cosmetic repair. So what you have are, you know, layers and layers of history that are just being covered over with modern establishments that look like any other city in the world. Cosmetic surgery is very popular. And she saw that as a very interesting metaphor for how people deal with their trauma, that they hide it inside and say, everything's fine, I'm great, look at me. Look at my new nose, you know. And it was just, it was kind of heartbreaking. And then, of course, in Palestine, you have people living under occupation, which is a totally different set of traumas to deal with, really. It was just interesting to see how different people deal with those aspects as well.
Well, Jemara, I wanted to ask you, because you've got Lebanese heritage, and you do you have family here as well?
Yeah.
And have you been back, and what are the contrasts there that you notice between, I guess, the migrant diaspora here and real life in Lebanon now?
Look, one of the main things that sticks out to me in terms of difference is that the Lebanese in Lebanon understand and feel quite profoundly that, you know, for well over two decades, we ripped each other apart. And in the Lebanese here, almost, and I think some of them weren't there for the war, but most of us who migrated saw a fair bit of it, behave as if the war had no impact. And as Amal was speaking, I was thinking, well, how does a country come to terms with ripping itself apart for absolutely no reason? And that's one of the reasons why Lebanese say it was a regional war. And so that's the really the main difference. You also see the Lebanese in Lebanon having culturally moved forward, and the Lebanese here holding on to what the dream of Lebanon.
There are some really interesting points within the book in that sense around the discussions around the hijab and people's different experiences here and there around choice and pressure and the meaning that it had for them. And one woman, she wore it here, but when she went to Egypt, it was a different situation. Can you tell us a bit about how that plays out for people?
Oh, yeah, that was Samah. She went to Egypt when people were taken to the streets, and she felt very emboldened by seeing that and wanted to be a part of it. She knew history was being made. And, of course, she's a feminist, and so when she got involved with the feminists there and she wore a hijab, they were really kind of funny about her bringing that into the cause. and they didn't want her to wear it, which is something that Mona Al-Tahawi also talks about. This sort of, if you're in the cause, you have to dress a certain way. Because Islam, whether people like it or not, that is the culture of the region. So actually, some women described the culture of the region as Muslim. So I'm Christian, but I live in a Muslim country, and it's culturally Muslim, and that's impacted how they were raised. So a lot of the time, what people are describing are cultural quirks and restrictions. It's a conservatism as opposed to a deeply held religious belief. And so it was interesting in that sense with hijab, especially because I actually wrote this entire pitch and didn't mention hijab. I'd written beyond veiled cliches, like, I don't want to talk about the veil. I didn't think about it. And then, of course, I realised very quickly that was the dumbest thing I could have done, because people want to talk about it. Women who wear it here want to talk about it. Women over there who don't wear it want to talk about it. People are obsessed with it. On every interview I ever do, people want to talk about hijab. It is something that really undoes people in a way that I can't quite fathom. It's something that I want to look at it and say, well, it's a piece of clothing that acts as an expression of faith for some. It's an armour for others. It's a flag. For some people, it is a form of oppression. And you have to acknowledge that. Like, there's no way you can say, oh, but no, every woman chooses to wear it. She doesn't. That's just a lie. But at the same time, in Australia, I would say, and I don't know how you feel about this, Jemana, but more women here are more likely to be choosing it than in the Middle East. That's what I feel, yeah. Anecdotally speaking. The influences overseas as well might be economic. So I was told very, very plainly that, well, sometimes women will put it on, not just because of social pressure, but because it's cheaper. Like, it's cheaper to wear an abaya, which is a long robe and a headscarf, than to try to keep up with the latest fashions. And the thing I find really interesting about hijab as well is I think people see it as some sort of barometer. They see it as like, this is the sign of a society in decay or in progress. And it really just depends on which side you're on, because I don't see it as either, but as history's shown us, women have agitated to have it on. Some women have said, I don't want to wear it, and they've burnt it. So it's almost like, do people understand how symbolic hijab is? It's actually, veils or any kind of clothing are so deeply symbolic for people, and it just tells you where they are, not necessarily like whether or not it's right or wrong. Or does that make sense? Like,
yeah, but, and it's hard to actually know why they have it on and what it means for them, and it's become far more difficult. I remember after September 11th, a lot of women put it on, and it was a sign of trying to reclaim Islam and to be Muslim. I'm not sure now what it means when a woman does put it on. It's become so profoundly complex. And for some women, it is exactly an act of faith and a desire to go inward and focus on one's faith. But for many other women, it's very different. At work, we've seen a lot of women put on the hijab when everybody in their family would really prefer they didn't. So it's a much more sort of almost a rebellious act sometimes.
And people think men are behind it. And no word of a lie, at an event recently I was asked how my partner, oh, you're wearing a ring, how did your partner feel about you taking it off? And I'm like, well, first of all, my husband is not, he's not Arab. When I took it off, I wasn't married. And it has nothing to do with him. It never has and it never will. It's my body. And I was so desensitized to these kinds of questions that it didn't occur to me to be offended until someone said, I can't believe that person asked you that. I said, what did they ask me? I actually forgot. And it's just, that's what happens. You start to actually, it loses its meaning. It stops being something you even get offended about because you just realize people are not even anywhere near where you are in terms of your progression on the issue or something like that. If that, you know, that idea of like, you've gone through these steps already, but other people haven't. So they can't appreciate the experience of it.
Well, I'm wondering if because there's been outcries on the right, there've been outcries on the left about, you know, how we should support or manage the issue of the hijab. Has any of that been at all useful to women in the Middle East or here?
Jamala.
No.
No. I'm not even sure women are listening. I think Amala's quite right when she says Arab women don't care.
They don't care.
And it does become sort of white noise. And it's not helpful. And because also the decisions are so profoundly personal, especially where Muslims are a minority, the young women are making decisions in a very personal way. And also, as Amal was saying, they don't necessarily mean anything anymore. It isn't, if you wear the hijab, you're conservative. If you don't wear it, you're progressive. If you wear the hijab, you're asexual. If you don't wear the hijab, you're sexual. It doesn't even speak to body politics anymore.
If you take it off, you've lost your faith, apparently.
Yeah.
And this is the interesting thing as well. Actually, the women care about hijab in the Middle East, but they don't care about it because Westerners care about it. So I'm not trying to put down the West. I come from the West. I love being here. It's not about that. But it's that sense of, I don't think people understand that these women have full capacity to analyse something on their own terms and say, I don't like it or I like it. They were very open about, for example, sexual harassment on the street and how much, I mean, they made some jokes. Like, one of them was joking and she said it in Arabic, but the equivalent of show us your, you know, what's, you know, like that kind of, I can say tits, right? Show us your tits. And like, they were joking about it, but I could tell that it was hard for them. And then I remember in Lebanon, this man was just asking me lots of questions. And then I think he was trying to determine if I had a husband, and I thought he was just disapproving because I was in the cab by myself. And so I realized after a while I was feeling uncomfortable, so I called him uncle, and he got really upset. And because I'd rejected him basically, and this woman's like, he wasn't curious, he was just having a crack at you. And I was like, oh, okay, I didn't like, why would I even look at, he's a taxi driver, like it wasn't, but it's that complicated for people. So the other thing is, that is another thing to think about, the issues there. I don't think Arab women are waking up going, well, hijab, that really bugs me. Like, it might be something they like or don't like, but it's not the thing that defines their lives. They are living full lives. It's really hard for some people to appreciate that.
Well, and I think the West seems obsessed with Islam and the Middle East and Arabs. And Arabs are like, why are you doing this? You know, what's going on? And I feel like I'm wondering if you get the sense that the West has this. It feels like it has a right to see everything and know everything. Mm. How do you write a book like this without kind of pandering to that obsession?
This is actually a really, really interesting question because I think I had to think about this morning when I was doing another interview, and I realised what it was, because I absolutely did not want to make things worse. I thought, I can't write a book that is not truthful. That was absolutely not an option. But how do I do this without, I guess, reinforcing the stereotypes and the misconceptions and not revealing complexity? And I realised that I just didn't think about the audience as being a Western audience. I didn't say, this is going to be your primer guide to the Middle East and Arab women, and you're going to feel better about us at the end. And I've said this, and I'll say it again, I'm not trying to convince you of anything. I don't want people to see this as a call to arms to say, oh, you know, you have to love me. I really don't care if you do or not. Like, it's great if you do, like, thank you. But it's really, I believe stories are a bridge. I think that the way we connect, the reason why people love movies, the reason why they love television shows is there's universality in them. Life is hard. That's what my screenwriting teacher told me. He said, life is hard. That's why we go to the movies. And I think that that's why we read stories. We're looking for points of connection. And I don't begrudge people wanting to understand. I admire that more than someone who doesn't want to.
Yep. Jumana, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've actually quite admired that tendency to want to know about other cultures. But I think it's how you want to know and what you're looking for. Mm. And I think there is something about if you're, you know, looking for the truth. And one of the things that Amal's book does is it has a lot of activist Arab women who have a lot to say. And that means that certain, that's sort of more, complicated curiosity is not going to be satisfied by reading that book. That book is more about actually wanting to know what Arab women think and feel and do in the Middle East and here.
When some of the projects that they were involved in sounded incredibly inspiring and are just hard work, you know, they're just going in at the coalface and supporting women and people from disadvantaged places. But it sounded like also that the idea, other people's ideas of what the ideal woman should look like, were actually having concrete effects, for example, in funding negotiations for NGOs and support groups in various places.
Yeah, a lot of NGOs will go into the Middle East and say, well, the topic du jour is so-called honour killing, so we'll only give you money around that. And that causes a lot of problems because guess what? Women still have other problems. Not every woman is at threat of that. And, I talk a little bit about the Nomalkuri incident. I think I probably wrote about her about five times and my editor was like, you've got to stop mentioning this. But I don't know if everyone's familiar with this, but a few years ago, Nomalkuri, she claimed to be fleeing Jordan. Her best friend Dahlia had been murdered by her family for falling in love with a Christian man, and she had a bestseller called Forbidden Love. And it turned out it was all a lie, and she's a sociopath. And she is. Like, if you watch the documentary Forbidden Lies, it's pretty obvious that she... I'm not judging, I'm telling you. It's a statement of fact.
You're just diagnosing.
She was actually diagnosed in it. Sorry, I should clarify. In this documentary, Forbidden Lies, the director says, I want to prove that she actually wasn't lying or that her intentions were good enough, that what she did not damage the cause. It absolutely did, by the way. It took the cause back 10 years. So what this director did was follow Nomalkuri around for I don't know how long. They even went back to Jordan. And she just, by the end of it, she was like, I can't justify this as truth. It's not truth. And literally people were diagnosing her as a sociopath. She just had ripped people off and done all these things. And the problem with that was she took a genuine cause and said, well, who cares if I lied? I didn't. But if I did, I'm bringing attention to something that's horrible. And it's really problematic because a lot of people said, well, see, you're just doing this now to pander to the West and we're not going to change our culture for the West. And it's really so much more complex than that. It's actually, murder is a crime in any culture. This is what happens when too many people are trying to stir the pot. And this is what the problem is, I think, with some of the NGO intervention, is that sometimes it doesn't quite hit the mark. It's about ticking boxes and it's saying, well, we need to be satisfied that women are now getting this or that. And one of the most inspiring women for me was Hadil, who in Jordan started the first legal aid organization in the country, and she met a lot of resistance from society. When I went to meet her, she said, I have to lock the door. She actually came in on her day off for me and said, I every day I'm getting calls from people saying you're the service that destroys families. Now, she started this service to just help people who were poor, who could not afford legal representation, and the majority of her clients are women, and she relies on international funding. The Bar Association in Jordan actually are objecting to her organisation, saying she's ruining the profession or affecting the profession, even though she hires like 50 plus lawyers. So can you imagine the cultural baggage you've got to deal with that? And I was so incredibly moved talking to her because she was one of those people who's so incredibly persistent and said, I won't stop. Like, I'm just going to keep doing it because if I can help one woman, then that's made a difference, and you have to look for those little moments. And so I think the good thing about the women there is they see that there are these problems, NGOs coming in and trying to direct and everything, but they just make the most of it. They say, well, we would like more unity, but unfortunately we've just got to try to do what we can.
And, they were doing, 2,400 cases a year out of a demand of 17,000. So she obviously felt like she needed to stick it out.
Yeah. If I became a millionaire overnight, I would send her a whole bunch of money, basically. Like, to me, I don't see anything mightier than that kind of person who says, I have a skill set and I want to help.
I wanted to talk about some of the things that these women told you that they loved about Arab culture, because that was a repeated theme for me, that things cropped up that were so important to them.
Family, the cultural aspects of, you know, even food, music, films. Nobody hates their culture.
it's actually, you're in it.
You're in it. It's actually, I don't think they even, but I think women would say things like, oh, like one woman I interviewed asked me about my husband, and I said, oh, well, he's not Arab. She goes, it's better for you, baby. And I thought, well, see, I get what she was saying, but I worry that if somebody from the West heard that and said, well, see, even she's telling you don't marry an Arab man, but that's not what she meant. It was just there's a complexity to that culture. And the fact is that actually some women expressed sorrow for men. They said, I actually feel sorry for the men in the Middle East because there is so much pressure on them in a patriarchal society to behave a certain way and to be a certain way. And they were really aware of that. It was really interesting to witness that. I don't know if that's something you come across sometimes, Jemana, in your own work, like the pressures on men and how that impacts family as well. But the love of the culture is there. Like it's,
yeah, it's quite profound.
And you said something in the book about how most people think when women hide away from their families, like hide like relationships or whatever, it's because they're afraid of punishment. A lot of the time it's just because they don't want to disappoint their parents who they love.
Yeah, and I think that you know, love of family isn't specific to Arab culture,
no.
But there is something around that it's almost an act of faith. You know, it
respect
is...
Respect is really big.
Yeah, and it's
culture.
Part of your sort of spiritual sort of development that you can honour and provide that sort of commitment and love. So, I think the other thing that I think to be in the Middle East and to watch people having lived through enormous human depravity because of war and dispossession and yet find so much love and kindness and politeness. When I went to Lebanon, my partner's also not Arab, and people were thrilled that he was there, and they were almost commending him for marrying me, you know.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
good
yeah.
on you sort of thing. It's like,
what, my chopped liver?
What is that about?
You score. I actually
yeah.
agree with that, because my husband was like, are they going to worry about me being a Westerner? I was like, I love you because you're a Westerner. It's
because
not...
there is an appreciation that people have taken the time to appreciate the culture, and I think, you know, if you've been at war for 30 years and you can take... satisfaction from somebody expressing an interest in your culture, that's a profound generosity, I think.
I like what you say in the book, Jemana, about, you know, there's this idea that families are oppressive and terrifying, but actually the girls love their families and don't want to disappoint them, like you said. But why does the West have this idea that they need to run in and rescue people from these terrifying, wonderful families?
You can take that one, Jemana.
I think there is something in the West that, you know, authenticity, independence, if you must be true to yourself, your failure to be true to yourself is if you put somebody ahead of you. And it's a very romantic idea, but it's slightly, it can be two-dimensional. When Amal did the interview with me, I was saying to her, I've made all my own choices around my life. And sometimes that has caused, particularly my mum, quite a bit of grief. And there is a question around how much do you owe those you love? And the young women we've worked with at work and in terms of my own sort of life experience, and I think Amal, you too, there is a question around, well, how much, what does actually loving a family member mean? And what do you owe them? And what is the priority here? You know, and they're complex questions that are really not easy to answer.
Deep, deep. It's
they're profoundly deep, and they don't necessarily have an answer, you know, and you can only sort of, you know, make your way through the best you can and try to honour yourself and honour those you love at the same time.
And there was one woman who I think summed it up. She said, you know, in the Middle East we live for others, and in the West they live for themselves, and that's why they're more advanced. And I was like, oh, there's quite a cost happening there.
Rana Hosseini said that. And I just wanted to say, I think that what's interesting for me as an adult, like my relationship to my parents has completely shifted. My perspective on them and their restrictions on me growing up have shifted quite profoundly. And I realised as I was writing the book that in a way it's harder to be the parent than the child, because you will grow up and eventually, like you said, make your own decisions and do things that they're not going to like, and it might be painful for them, but they will stay the way they are and they will have to experience those things happening to them, whereas they're just trying to protect you when you're younger. So it's this strange, like, just, you know, about face that you do, almost like, oh, okay, this is a different perspective that I can see now. And there was just one other thing I wanted to say. It's just running through my mind, this idea of, because we keep saying, oh, Arab women don't care what you think. It's more that it doesn't occur to them to think about it, because they're just living their lives. But the one time I was asked, what do they think, it was by a man, and he was Palestinian, and I just met him because, so Arabs are very big on hospitality, and my big beef is when everybody just bangs on about it all the time. Like, that's the one redeeming feature of the Arab culture, is they're so hospitable. And I always say, but oh my God, like, what does that mean? And but actually, like, you can't even begin to understand how hospitable they are. I guarantee if any of you went to Jordan, you'd be invited at least once by a complete stranger to their house for lunch, and it would be safe for you to go. And when my husband and I were going to the West Bank, you know, what you do is you gather up enough people to go into a taxi, and you'll pay a share of the fare. And we eventually realised we weren't going to get the numbers, and so we all banded together. And the taxi driver didn't know where our hotel was, so unbeknownst to me, two people in the car just organised our lift to the hotel and just said, oh, it's okay, my brother's picking me up, I'll take them. And I found this out later. And Chris was uncomfortable, but I was like, oh, well, what do you do? You know, like, so we got out of this taxi, and these people are like shoving things out of the way in the back boot for us. And Chris is like, I don't know about this. I was like, just, we're going with them. Like, nothing's going to happen. It'll be fine. And I mean, because I can speak the language adequately enough, I understood that these guys weren't going to hurt us. And so we're sitting in the car with them, and they were like, so what do people think about Palestine? What do they? And that was the only time I was ever asked, what are the perceptions of us in the West? And it was actually kind of heartbreaking to me, because he was clearly a very accomplished man who had travelled a lot, and his life was not like the snapshot of Palestine, like the aggrieved man who has, like, it absolutely has problems. But this idea that we can't rise above those or be more than that, like, we are living and breathing Palestine all the time, it was kind of sad. And of course, he gave us his number at the end, by the way. Like, if you need anything, give us a call. So that's what they're like there.
Oh, there was one interesting thing you wrote about your parents being a little anxious about your relationship with Chris because they felt that he could never connect to the culture in a meaningful way. Has that played out, or has there been a shift in that feeling?
He likes the food a lot. Tried to learn the language. He did try to learn the language. He loved the Middle East. I think it was more my mum. I think my dad is quite practical. My dad's currency is probably a bit different to my mum's. My mum, I think, cared about the fact that he was not Arab, because I think she felt like, I don't know how he thinks, how is he going to treat my daughter? These things come out later, because in the moment there's just fear or anger or whatever. But it played out very differently in the sense that, yeah, he's not Arab, but he's kind and he's good and he's hospitable, and his parents are like so similar to my parents. Like, he's warned me, he's like, my mother is just like your mother, we've got to be careful. And when we got engaged, my mother was standing next to his mother, and they were like head to head talking, and they were like identical height, same body type, and the only difference was my mum's headscarf. That was it. And she wears like this little gypsy headscarf, and it was just, I just looked and I went, oh my God, like, they're twins.
And there's this interesting contrast with one of the other women you spoke to. Said, look, bonding with someone, belonging is not about your faith or your culture or where you're born. It's just that kind of, she was talking about it as a kind of sacred space of the self where you sit down, have a cup of tea, and you bond.
Mm, yeah.
Is that, what are your thoughts on that? Because some people would say, look, that's a very culturally shaped thing, and maybe you can't bridge that ever fully. And some people would say, look, you know, yeah, marry someone of a different background, it's going to be fine.
I think the issue for me when I think of things like that is that her triumph was that she became an individual. And that's the thing we struggle with as humans. We're inherently tribal. And I'm guilty of it myself. I find that the greatest achievements I've made in my life, or the greatest moments of joy or movement or progress, have been when I have looked at myself as an individual person and not as the product of a culture or a religion or the daughter of these immigrants, or, you know. And it's not to say these things stop matter, that they don't matter anymore, but there's a real danger in becoming a product almost. I have to be this. And that's where I think what she's trying to say is that if you go deep down into who you are, that's where you find that's the good stuff. Like, it's what we're seeking is connection as human beings. And in the West, the difference is we have to seek connection with a lot of people who don't necessarily make sense to us. In the Middle East, it's different. It's like we all make sense to each other because we're all the same, and that's it, end of story. You know? So it's like this kind of interesting, the reason why people, why the disruption in the Middle East is so hard is because it is scary for a culture that does value that tribalism. And as Jumana said, family is everything. Like the respect you have for your parents does not go away.
Can I, just in relation to coupling up with somebody from, you know, a different culture, I think that sometimes, you know, for Arabs and Muslims, there's a lot of, they're really under the microscope around partnering up, and if they only marry within their group, it's seen as a issue of racism or prejudice. But in fact, everybody tends to marry people from the same class, same nationality, probably same political persuasion. I think men, obviously because they have more economic power, may marry a class down, but women don't. They tend to marry a class up. And I hope, you know, with equality, I'm sure they'll not discriminate differently. But we do tend to make those decisions around what is going to make this relationship safe and sustainable.
Comfortable.
Yeah. Well, just sustainable and safe, you know, that the more we marry people who are like us, the more likely that the relationship is to continue. But when we talk about minorities, we always couch it as an issue about race. And actually, your parents, like my parents, would have been around, well, how will this relationship play out? Because we don't know what rules operate in that other culture.
Yeah.
And so a lot of fear develops with that.
And they also worry you're going to lose respect for your culture or your attachment to your culture through that person. So you can imagine my dad's delight when I took Chris to Palestine. Like, he was so happy, and I couldn't believe it. I'm walking through my dad's town with this very Anglo man who used to be my manager years ago. It was weird. It was so surreal. So it was, yeah.
We will go to questions, but I just very quickly want to end with Muriel and why you wanted to finish the book with her story.
I wouldn't want to write a whole chapter on Muriel, but she's, I guess, the Arab world's first female cinematographer, and she has a beautiful web series called Ziyara, which is all about life journeys. And she's a cinematographer, so her partner interviews the people, but she films them. And then you don't see the person's face until the end, I think, and all that sort of thing. And she was just, I just had this just strong, strong connection to her, and I knew she had to be in the book in some way. And somehow putting her at the end felt right, because she was the summary in my mind of what is a great way to look at things, which is that, yes, we have problems, but... And I feel like that's kind of what the book is saying, that it's not trying to deny anything. It's not trying to solve the problems overnight and say we can just wave a magic wand and everything's going to be great. These are deep-seated issues that are rooted in history. And so, but people going through these experiences don't think of them that way. So I remember one person commenting that it doesn't really talk about the sort of post-colonialism of the era. It's like, because people don't talk like that. They don't think that way. They don't think in academic terms. They think in real life experience. And what am I going through right now? And she was somebody who was very accepting of life's challenges and said, I can fight them, or I can try to make life beautiful. And so she had a really beautiful way of looking at the world, that people have choice, even if it's at a sort of a soul level, I think. And I was just so profoundly moved to hear someone speaking like that in Lebanon, given their history and given the fact that she had just met me, but we could have talked all day. So, yeah.
So many of the stories were like that for me. It's like, oh, I'm sitting at a table with you guys and just listening to you talk. It was really interesting.
That's what I hoped for. I really wanted that. I wanted, like I say, at the beginning of the book, I don't want you to read this. I want you to listen to it.
Yep, like, you know. It's got a real audio feel about it. And there'll be book signings at the end. Metropolis Books are up the end. You can buy your copy there too. Now we'll go to questions. Find someone with a microphone. Stick your hand up, and they'll come to you.
Hi. My family background is Polish, and my parents migrated here after World War II. And I'm aware that as a child who has been grown up in Australia in a peaceful environment, nonetheless, I've picked up some of the traumas of my parents psychologically and emotionally. So I'm just offering this as a statement to ask you about Arabic families and mothers. What are they hoping for their children? And you're saying the conflict keeps going on. You know, where do they see the change happening for the next generation? How will that peace come?
I mean, it depends on which country you're talking about, the circumstances. So, for example, in Palestine, one woman I spoke to, she basically said, you're not going to get intervention here until it's in the world's interest to help solve this problem. In Lebanon, I would say that there is definitely inherited trauma, which is kind of what you're alluding to. I do believe in that, actually. I really believe we inherit trauma. I think this new generation of women are taking their energy and directing it in a way that is helping people who might go through the same thing. So refugees are a huge issue, like in the Middle East, because so many Middle Eastern countries are taking in a lot of refugees that they can't necessarily afford to accommodate. So in Lebanon, for example, Nora Jumblatt is like leading this charge for education for girls. That is her big thing. Or education for girls and boys, but especially girls. She's like, we cannot afford to skip this. You know, there's a, I think, was it, they think that a lot of Syrian refugee kids will be the lost generation because they're not getting the education that they need. So she's all over that. She's trying to stop that from happening, educating thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands of...
I think you said there were 500,000 Syrian kids and only 200,000 of them were in school.
Maybe, yeah. So I don't remember the figures. I read it a while ago. So that was another thing. And I spoke to this woman as well, Zina, who she works with... refugee women to help them through drama therapy. And she was telling me that this is a really beautiful story. She said that a lot of these women needed to find work and they had no skills. They could not read. They were literate. And they said, our parents never, you know, thought that this was going to happen. They never thought we would need these skills. I'm not going to let that happen to my children. So I always think that there's a solution or there's a way forward. And I absolutely feel like I felt... Like, I kind of wrote this book and got a little bit depressed. Like, I won't lie. I felt sad. I felt really sad at how much trouble there is in the world and how broken people are. And I don't think that's an Arab thing. I really don't. I think all you need to do is just go to Twitter and you just say one thing that's wrong and, you know. But the thing that gave me hope when I wrote the book was that there were so many women saying... I'm not going to look at the problem. I'm going to look at the solution. I'm going to say, well, what's the way forward? What am I going to do that will change that? So so-called honor killings in Jordan seemed like an insurmountable problem. It was cultural. And even men were helping women, activists, change the cultural mindset so that people no longer looked at that murder as an honorable one. And so now the sentence has climbed to like 20 years from a few months. And there are still some issues around that. And I go into more detail in the book, but... That's amazing.
And I'll just get you to keep your questions very succinct. We've got about 8 minutes left and it'd be great to get a few questions heard.
Thank you to the Wheeler Centre and you guys for an absolutely fantastic discussion. You've said some very favourable things about Arab culture and some not so favourable things, which I found very interesting for you to say that. Can I ask you to reflect on, there's about 1.5 million Arab people living in Israel. In Israel. You reflect on the lives of Arab, the people in Israel and Arab people in Saudi Arabia, especially women?
Did you say Israel?
Yeah.
Israel versus Saudi Arabia?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Could you be a bit more specific? What exactly are you...
Well, you've alluded to some interesting aspects.
Are you talking about Palestinians? Versus
no, I'm talking. We're talking about Arab culture, aren't we, rather than Palestinian culture?
Well, no, but you're talking about a specific area, right? So I just want to be clear on. Do you mean West Bank, Gaza? Are you talking about those specific areas?
No. Israel. Okay, if you want to dissect Israel, Israel as a whole has about 1.6 million Arab residents and/or citizens. Can you reflect on the lives of Arabs in Israel as a whole versus the lives of people in Saudi Arabia, especially women?
Like apples and oranges, I guess. I don't know. Palestinians have a very different set of problems, but that's not to say women who are living in Palestine don't have other issues to deal with. Living under occupation actually sets a very certain tone to your life. So already you're at a disadvantage in how you live your everyday life. Then in Saudi Arabia, the issue with Saudi Arabia is that they have a guardianship system. So the guardianship system treats women like minors. You don't have that as a Palestinian woman. So they're just, I wasn't being fresh with you. I'm trying to just understand exactly what you want to know, because it's to me, this is such a broad topic. I can talk all day about what it's like to be a Palestinian woman versus a Saudi woman, but I don't know what it's like to be a Saudi woman personally. I didn't go there, so I didn't spend a lot of time on that.
So there is an excellent story about how Saudi women kind of were hanging out in the back of cars singing songs.
Yeah, there's a video clip. Look it up online. Some Saudi women did a very irreverent video clip basically objecting to the guardianship system. So I really recommend watching that. It's quite
good. Men give us psychological illnesses.
Yeah.
Finish. Another question?
Yes. My question is how you went about sampling those particular women that showed up in your book. So basically, why did you choose those women and why did you omit some others? And were there any cases of women who were living just like everyday lives, not flashy lives out in the spotlight? And are those in your book? Have you omitted them? And if you can just give us some instances of cases that you chose to omit and why?
Every woman in the book is an everyday woman. I didn't go after superstars. I went after women who were active, and they were active in society in some way. So in order for the book to be dynamic, you need action. And so that was my motivation there. And obviously there are a lot of limitations in terms of time. I wish I could speak to every kind of woman, and I can't. I can try to cover the issues of wealth, class, all of those things. What I chose to omit was generally if the story was really interesting but personal. So sometimes women shared very personal journeys, and they were very moving and beautiful stories, but they weren't sort of, they were so specific to them that I couldn't fit them into the book for space. In terms of they're really the only ones. I didn't censor anyone. That was not something I did. The book is very non-judgmental. At least that was my intention. I think I have achieved that. I'm not sort of the adjudicator. I don't write these stories and then say, well, this is right and this is wrong. I honestly just try to give people the breadth of experiences that I came across. And acknowledge the limitations. It's one book, and I know that. And I'm not trying to answer every question. It's just impossible to do that.
We've got time for one, possibly two more questions. While we're waiting for the microphone to get there, I just loved the story about the woman who found this insight into her faith through veganism.
Yes.
We won't go into it, but it was really, really interesting.
Yeah, these women who were really environmentally conscious and found connection to their faith through that. It was quite beautiful to find out, actually. That was her identity. She found her identity through veganism. I thought, well, that's a whole other set of judgment she's going to have to deal with now.
Yeah.
That's a really good segue to my question, because I want to ask you about identity. I'm an Australian-born Arab woman, so my parents are Lebanese and I was born here. And I think when I think about my identity, I think about myself as a woman first, and then I think about myself as an Arab and an Australian. And I'm just wondering about the connective thread for you when you were looking at these women and what connected them as Arab women. Or did you find a connection?
In Australia, or you mean
no,
everywhere?
No, in your book. Everywhere. So all the women that you interviewed who were Arab, they were Arab women. And was there something that made them uniquely Arab? Was there something that connected them that has made them stand out as opposed to other than where they were born?
I would probably say it's the loyalty to family, to be honest. That was the one thing that was so constant and consistent. I did not meet a single woman who just did not have some sort of strong connection to her family roots. And the, I don't know, like fealty to culture a little bit, like the cultural relevance in their lives was always there. In Australia, I would say, though, that some of the older Muslim women I interviewed, for example, and they're not all Muslim women in the book, I think that they were a lot more sort of focused on the faith from a very technical perspective. So they said, I'm going to separate culture from the religion. But I don't think even, I think even like the, I have this sort of weird theory that I think a lot of families are conservative, but they're not religious. And there is a bit of a difference. Like conservative families will say, you can't go out past this time, you have a curfew. A religious family might say, it's okay, come home, but just text me when you're on your way home. but then they'll have other restrictions. And so that's what I witnessed in Australia. And even in the Middle East, I think that's true. So Jumana, I hope that answers your question anyway.
Did you want to add anything to that, Jumana?
I was just thinking about the question.
It's a hard one, I think.
Yeah, it's a complex one. You know, since September 11th, I think a lot of Arabs think of themselves as Muslim. And so the sort of Arab identity has sort of, you know, sort of gone into the background a little bit. And in speaking to Amal, it sort of came back up for me. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's right, that's who I am. And it was a really nice feeling of just coming into oneself. I was just interested that, you know, there's now a push, you know, you've got to identify as Australian, you've got to identify as Australian, and you have to declare where you sit, which I actually really don't understand. I don't understand how people identify with a nation. You know, I feel Lebanese because of my childhood experiences, but I don't feel patriotic towards Lebanon, in a sense, in the way that I might get called to do it as an Australian. And actually what I feel most often is I'm a Melburnian. Rest of Australia doesn't make much sense to me, actually. I just feel profoundly Melburnian.
I was so struck by one line in the book where you said these women were all conflicted by life's duties and pulled towards life's joys, and that just sounds so familiar, doesn't it? I want to thank you both so much for speaking with us tonight.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.